It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Legislative action taken by the then Republican-controlled Congress 13 months ago is now impacting taxpayers as they fill out their returns. One of the provisions of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act includes a higher threshold for deductions on charitable donations. Philip Hackney is an associate professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh. He focuses on nonprofits and charities. He was also attorney for the chief counsel of the IRS, specializing in nonprofit organizations from 2006 to 2011. Phil, welcome to the Confluence.
Yeah, thank you for having me here.
So I want to start off with, how did you blend two of your interests, tax law and nonprofits?
Yeah, no, great question. I was working for a big law firm in Houston, Texas, doing corporate securities and finding ways to help corporate clients tear down redwood forests. And I working ridiculous hours, and I talked with my wife, and she convinced me that, I needed to have a change. And so I started looking around for what I wanted to do with my life, and I decided I wanted to either teach or do public policy work in tax in particular. If I wanted to do that, where did I want to focus? I thought it would be something along the lines of charity, where I felt like I was doing something good, so I could figure out some way of using my legal talents and transactional talents and bring betterment to the world. So it kind of collided in a sense of frustration with where I was, but connected also with the type of work I'd done in the past.
So how did your work with the IRS sort of tap into that interest?
Sure. So in 2005, I left my law firm and went up to NYU to get my master's in tax law and an LLM up there. And my wife and children stayed back, 7 and 2. And it was a challenging year. But when I went up there, I actually I connected very strongly with who's now very much my mentor, Jill Manny, a professor there at NYU. She connected me with a good friend of hers, Kathy Livingston, who became my boss at the IRS, to work for the tax-exempt organizations there in the IRS. So it was via getting a master's and then connecting with the people of the world that were doing that stuff, and it ended up being a great match.
Okay. So last year at this time, taxpayers filling their returns who were itemizing using Schedule A, for example, what was the threshold at that time for charitable donations?
Yeah, so it's an odd aspect, kind of in the weeds, so I'll try and make it kind of as simple as you can. But, most of us will either itemize or we'll take a standard deduction.
Right.
So those who fill out their return know they have either a standard deduction or if they beat the standard deduction, they can itemize. Well, for a single individual, it was about $6,000 before you could itemize. And for a couple, myself, my wife and I think it was $12,600 the year before, not in the coming year.
Right, filing jointly, yeah.
Congress decided they wanted to simplify. I think this was the idea. So they wanted to cut out more people itemizing. So what they did is they significantly increased the standard deduction. So instead of $6,000 for a single individual, it's $12,000. I think it's $12,400. I have to go back and look. And then for a married couple like myself, you've got to have itemized expenses in excess of $24,000. That means for a couple, most of you are not going to be doing it unless you have significant home mortgage interest, significant state taxes. Most people are not going to be hitting that $24,000 area, which means that you're not going to be able to take a charitable contribution deduction.
So
you're not itemizing, you're not taking a charitable contribution deduction. If you don't get over $12,000 as a single person, you're not doing it. And if you don't get over $24,000 of itemized deductions as a married couple, it ain't happening.
Yeah, you said it's not happening. I saw an estimate from the Tax Policy Center that the number of households claiming a deduction for donations, in other words, itemizing donations to nonprofits, will drop from about 37 million to 16 million households. Sort of agree with that estimate?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's possible that it's quite a bit more than that. I'm not estimating,
right,
but I've seen it's, prior to the act, anywhere from about a little over 30% of the population was itemizing. I have seen predictions that it will be as low as 7% of people itemizing, which would put that number lower than just cutting it in half. So my guess is fewer people, but we'll find out.
So now that the standard deduction is much higher,
yep,
people won't reach that threshold to really benefit from itemizing. What does that mean for charities who would be receiving the donations?
Yeah, it the expectation is that donations are going to go down. A lot of folks that are really into the weeds suggest that it wouldn't happen in 2018 because most people were not aware of the law, were not aware of the impact. Until it actually impacts your pocket,
right,
it's just not going to happen. People were expecting down giving of about $18 billion. Billion, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In 2017, there was about a $410 billion contributed to charity. So $20 billion is not a huge amount of that, but it's a significant amount,
right,
to food banks. I think the question is where it's happening. I have a feeling that it's going to happen in those food banks and the soup kitchens, not in the colleges and universities. The giving will continue there, because I think the question is, why do people give? We'll see. We'll see how it turns out.
So what's your take on the idea people will still give, but maybe they give a little more or significantly more so that they could claim that deduction?
So most people won't be able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I gave a pretty significant chunk this mm-hmm. year as far as my salary goes.
Right.
And I know I won't be hitting. It's just not going to happen because I'm not going to get above 24,000. I mean, let's start with housing interest.
Right.
Say you've got a $300,000 note on your home. That's a pretty sizable mortgage for most people. You might be hitting $12,000, $13,000 of interest. That's only getting you half of the way there to the $24,000 amount.
And that's the big one.
Yeah, and that's your big one. And maybe you've got some state and local. You get another $5,000, $6,000 in there, and you're still way short. You've got to do a lot of giving before it ends up starting to benefit you in a tax sense.
Mm-hmm.
So with most people, unless you're making substantial money, it's just not going to happen.
Right. Steve Taylor from the United Way Worldwide was quoted as saying, "We know that the main reason why people give to charity is not the tax incentive. We also know that the tax incentive allows people to give a little bit more than they would have otherwise." So people might give less, but you brought up something interesting there. It's whom they give to as well. That's what concerns you. So you say maybe the education institutions will still get it, but the other, shall we say, the more charitable,
yep,
organizations might get hurt?
I think that's right. I mean, when I'm thinking about these questions, I think there are certain organizations where it's in your interest to give.
Mm-hmm.
Your private school where your child goes, there's a lot of pressure, social and otherwise, for you to continue to giving there. And I'm not saying that that's a bad place to give, only that that's the place where giving is going to continue. Giving will continue in churches. People give to your church, whether it's there or not. There's lots of folks that tithe.
Because
it's a part of who they are and what they must do.
Exactly. They already have a vested interest because they're participating in that.
Exactly. They're part of that community. But the food bank, I think, is something that falls outside the, you know, we'll see. I've seen incredible giving over the past year for disasters with hurricanes and fires and so on. And I have great belief in the American people on these things. But it's going to have an impact at the margin for sure. There's just no doubt about it. And I think it's going to happen in the places where we need right now.
Right. And it seems like who you're alluding to, who you're mentioning, these are organizations that rely so much on donations. They don't have a whole lot of other outlets to raise revenues to provide the services that they do.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. They don't have ways of charging people money for the services because the people can't pay. They need it.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives me pause for great concern. I worry about it. I mean, the interesting thing to me about it is the federal government collected less in revenue as a result of this tax cut. And that has to mean you're going to have less in social services from the federal government. And at the same time, they had an impact on charity. This is the thing that gives me the greatest concern. We're going to be putting more stress on our charities. At the same time, we're taking dollars away from them that they sorely need.
Phil Hackney is an associate professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh. He focuses on nonprofits and charities. We've been talking about the new tax law and how it could impact charities and donations. In our last couple of minutes, I did want to ask you, we're still have a government shutdown. 46,000 IRS workers will come back to work for tax filing season later on under the agency's new emergency plan. White House says tax returns won't be affected. Is that true?
Will they be affected? Absolutely, they're going to be affected. I mean, you have a new tax law and you have a shutdown in the middle of it, and the tax law is highly complex. It takes an incredible amount of effort to prepare, to have all that stuff ready. I was questioning whether they were ready to do that in the first place, but you're not paying these 46,000 employees. A few of them are getting, a small percentage are getting some pay,
right,
but the vast majority of them are not. I don't see a good prognosis on this return year. I hope it's going to be better than that, but with this situation, I'm very concerned about what's going to happen in this season.
Still withholding the taxes, it's the processing of those forms and getting your refunds that will be delayed?
Yeah, no, I mean, we'll see. I think you could have refund delays. That's one of the no-nos. I understand when I joined the IRS many years ago, the one thing a commissioner cannot fail on is getting those refunds out. If they do, it's a big no-no.
Okay. We've been talking about the impact of the tax reform law. You testified before Congress last month on nonprofit oversight. Why did they call on you to testify? But most of all, what do you feel needs to be done in government's oversight of nonprofits?
Yep. So let me focus on what needs to be done in terms of nonprofit oversight. The reality is there was a ProPublica article that came out right about that time that I went and testified, and they called me because they wanted me to focus on the Trump Foundation as opposed to the Clinton Foundation.
Right.
But the reality is the IRS is the main game in town that oversees nonprofits. It doesn't have the resources it needs to do the work it needs to do. It has 10,000 auditors, fewer than 10,000 auditors today. The last time it had that, 1953.
And so what does it need to do? Briefly?
Needs more resources. Congress needs to appropriate more resources to this and have the folks on the ground. It's boots on the ground, not the law that's in place. The law in place, I think, is fine. I think it's having the people to oversee the nonprofits that are out there.
So policy's okay. It's just people to implement?
Yeah, I think we could improve on policy at the edge, but we don't have people watching these organizations, and people are taking advantage of them, I believe.
Philip Hackney is an associate professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh. He focuses on nonprofits and charities. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure, and have a great day.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. The Confluence airs live from 9 to 10 a.m., but the news never stops. Find more stories, conversations, and more on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. What can we learn from a close look at a small town in West Virginia? That's the question John Miller and David Bernabo ask in their documentary film Moundsville, about the town an hour southwest of Pittsburgh named for its ancient Native American burial mound. 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll asked Miller how the project began.
I moved to Pittsburgh from Belgium in 2011, and Moundsville just caught my eye one day driving back from a coal mine. I was covering the coal industry for the Wall Street Journal. And as somebody who is American but grew up overseas, I'm fascinated by places that tell you a bigger story about this country. And Moundsville is a place that had this incredible height of industry in the 50s. It had one of the world's biggest toy factories, one of the world's biggest glass factories, a stamping factory, all this industrial might and prosperity. And the context, obviously, is the 2016 election with everybody talking about why these small Rust Belt towns voted for Donald Trump. And here was an opportunity to tell a story that might help explain that. And of course, in the movie, there's one line, a very small throwaway line about Trump. So Trump's not in the movie, but we hope to tell a deeper story.
So let's do the clip.
I can understand leaving because Moundsville doesn't have what the youth are looking for today. They're looking for diversity, or they're looking for different things, or they're looking for themselves, what they're looking for, I think.
And so that was Les Barker, who's a retired boiler operator. He's an older gentleman, and he was one of the 24 people who appear in the film as interview subjects. So talk about that quote for a little bit.
So a couple things. I mean, Les is the kind of guy that out-of-town reporters might meet at a diner and might spend, you know, 3 minutes talking to. And we spent 3 hours talking to him. And not everything he said was profound and thoughtful, but there were some nuggets in that conversation that really got to a deeper part, a deeper place of conversation with the stereotypical old white guy in Appalachia. He was very reflective, even at one point, talking about the arrival of the big box stores. And he has a great line in the movie: "I think we, the people, did this to ourselves. We wanted everything cheaper," which is a true fact about the American consumer society, that we have embraced cheap goods from China, and that has contributed to decline in manufacturing in this country.
You know, if you're talking about the reasons that towns decline, your take on it is there's many reasons, right? There's not just one. It's not just jobs going overseas. It's not because of immigrants coming and taking jobs.
One of the main arcs of our story is about Mark's Toy Plant, which was one of the biggest toy factories in the world and made Rock'em Sock'em Robots and the Big Wheel. And at some point, people stopped buying Big Wheels for their kids, or stopped buying Rock'em Sock'em Robots, or they moved to video games. I mean, video games are a reason that the Mark's Toy Plant closed. And what can you do about that? I mean, Americans have a hard time accepting that capitalism has this life cycle of creation and destruction.
You point out in the film that there are some new things going on there. There's new kinds of industry in the town. They have a lot of tourism for a number of reasons. The mound itself, the old penitentiary that's closed. They have a lot of ghost tourism. Are those things sort of a true way forward for the community, or are they just kind of like a stopgap measure?
In this wilderness of kind of the kind of industry, there's opportunity. I mean, one of the couples in our movie is a young couple that returned to having a small family farm while he drives a school bus. And so there's sort of spaces where people can start new things. And that's one thing that's happening in Appalachia that is not talked about enough, is that there are young creative people doing different kinds of things and building a new kind of future. And we're not going back to the past. And one thing the mound reminds us of is that civilizations and cultures do eventually move on, and change is inevitable.
And he had a screening in Moundsville.
And so this became like a sort of anthropological experiment. It's like, what's the reaction going to be of these people? And the movie is partly about decline. So I was nervous. Like, what if they think we're, you know, these city outsiders, like we're going to trash their town? And they loved it. I was very, like, you know, relieved, because they liked the fact that we didn't talk about Trump. They liked the fact that we focused on their story and that we asked people about stuff they knew a lot about.
That's 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll speaking with documentarian John Miller. Moundsville gets its Pittsburgh premiere with a screening Thursday at the Carnegie Museum of Art. You're listening to The Confluence on WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. One Hood Media is a collective of artists and activists who use art as a way to increase awareness about social justice and how it affects people, not just in Pittsburgh, but across the country and beyond. Independent hip-hop artist and One Hood co-founder Jaziri X joins us today to talk about that mission and what could be next. Jaziri, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you for having me.
All right. You demonstrate your activism through your music, also through other relationships and in communities you create for others. One artist can make a difference, but what is the impact? What's the potential impact when you have a collective of artists that come together and work together?
I mean, I think I would argue that you make better music. I mean, oftentimes I think when you see your favorite artists, you know, they're operating inside a collective. You know, they're operating with songwriters, they're operating with music producers, you know. So if you see Michael Jackson, you know what I'm saying, Quincy Jones was there, songwriters were there, other musicians were there. And so I think, you know, you have a tendency to come with better art. But I also think, you know, it's like being in a choir, you know. It's one thing for one person to sing, but when you have, you know, individuals all coming together, harmonizing, all kind of on one accord, you can maybe build a certain not only level of artistry, but you can, you know, build a necessary group that can actually really make some real changes. And so for us at One Hood, you know, it's not about making art for art's sake. It's really about making art that we feel either, you know, talks about certain subjects that might not be addressed, or really kind of like moves the culture forward, moves the city forward, moves the nation forward. And so we're really about, you know, coming together collectively, and that unity being one of the things that can empower, you know, artists or groups to make a real change.
You can harmonize musically, but you're also harmonizing through your messaging.
Absolutely. Correct. And I think, you know, the idea is to try to reach a critical mass where that messaging becomes, you know, something that really affects the way, you know, things change. I mean, I'm somebody that, you know, because of the type of music that I make, I've often been in political spaces. And I will always say to political folks that cultural change always precedes political or policy change. That first, you know, it's a change in culture. And then oftentimes when that culture is accepted, that change in culture accepted, you actually see policy. I think we saw that around, you know, one example I give is around marriage equality, mm-hmm. where first culturally people began to accept it and then policy changes. So culture always comes first. So we're trying to lead culturally on many of these issues so we can have, you know, the real equality, the, you know, I always say like the America we were promised, whereas justice and equality for everyone, that's ultimately what we want.
So art and culture out front again?
Absolutely, yes.
So there seems to be multiple purposes, multiple goals for One Hood Media. What would you say they are? And as a leader, as an artist yourself?
Well, so One Hood Media actually started because the Heinz Endowment and Pew Center did a study that you could find on Heinz's website, heinz.org, called Portraits and Portrayals, which was specifically around how black men were portrayed in the media here in Pittsburgh. They studied, you know, all of the media, and they came to the conclusion that roughly around 90% of the time that you see black men in the media, the subject is crime. That when it comes to quality of life stories about black men, it's less than 3%. And so at the time, you know, I participated in the study and I had begun to emerge nationally as a hip hop artist. You know, myself, I kind of went to Heinz and said, hey, we want to teach young black men how to not only analyze media, most of the media that's directed towards us. That often highlights the most negative aspects of our community. We don't own. We don't control these images. So we wanted to not only teach young black men how to analyze media, but create media for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so it became, even though, you know, a year later we had, you know, young women become a part of One Hood, and we kind of opened One Hood up to youth of color and youth in general. The whole idea is really for us to tell our own story. Like, there's power in you telling your own story, not only, you know, being heard, but also, you know, if somebody else is telling your story, they're probably going to get it wrong. They don't know you as well. And so part of what we began to try to do and understand is the narrative. You know, when you look at, you know, we're bringing in Sabrina Fulton tonight. And when you look at what happened with her son, Trayvon, you had somebody basically pass judgment on him. Never had a conversation, didn't know who he was, but saw a young black man. And because he saw a young black man, in his words, with a hoodie on, he automatically said, that's a criminal, you know. And well, if you're somebody in Pittsburgh, you might have that same reaction, because 90% of the time that you see a black man in the news, it's because of crime.
Right.
And so if, when you have all of these black men in the city of Pittsburgh doing positive things, contributing to their communities, and it's not being covered, those quality of life stories, those success stories aren't covered, then you're actually being programmed to look at me in a particular way. And so what we wanted to do was say, you know what, we're going to tell our own stories. We're going to tell our own narratives. We're going to express ourselves in a way that now, if you see it, if you hear it, you get a different idea, point of view about who we really are. And I think that's where we ended up becoming an artist collective, and we ended up being this group that began to use our voice and art to speak to social change. But we really started to, like, tell our own story.
So, Sabrina, the mother of Trayvon, as you mentioned, of course, to remind our listeners, Trayvon was killed by George Zimmerman,
yes.
A neighborhood watch coordinator. He was tried and acquitted on Florida's Stand Your Ground defense laws.
Correct.
What do you hope to hear from Ms. Fulton?
Well, I think that, you know, the timing of this couldn't be better for our city. I mean, you know, I look at what the city of Pittsburgh went through last year. It was very, we went through a lot of several tragedies. Antoine Rose, we went through the massacre at the Tree of Life Synagogue. Right. And so here's a woman that has, you know, through tragedy, you know, not only maintained dignity, but came out of it as somebody that's an activist herself now, that, you know, has an organization that helps mothers that lost children to violence, not just police violence, but also gun violence. You know, she's an author, and she's really began to dedicate her life to making sure that, you know, what happened to her son doesn't happen not only in Florida, but all over the country. And so how do we respond to tragedy and tragic circumstances in a way where we can actually produce real change? You know, how do we deal with a high profile case of a young man being murdered? You know, Antoine Rose, 17 years old, unarmed, shot three times in the back by an East Pittsburgh police officer here in Pittsburgh. How do we deal with that as a community, as a city? How can we come out of it where this loss wasn't in vain, this life wasn't taken in vain, but we see, you know, real community change where that doesn't happen again? We just saw a young man that was killed in gun violence, you know, Jonathan Friedman, who was an Alder Dyce student. How do we prevent these things from happening in our city? How do we move forward? And so I think, you know, because of Sabrina's own life experience, she can provide some insight for us as a city.
Of course, the jury selection is supposed to start pretty soon in the trial of East Pittsburgh, former East Pittsburgh officer Rosfeld, in the shooting death of Antoine Rose. So did the death of Antoine Rose, did that play a role in your inviting?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I remember one of the events that we did in, I believe it was 2014. We did an event and we did a conversation, a community conversation. It was called Could Pittsburgh Be the Next Ferguson? And I remember we got a lot of pushback from, you know, particularly, you know, people that was in law enforcement. And, you know, we were saying, like, we're not having this conversation because that's what we want to see. What we're saying is we have some of those same conditions that could lead to something that would happen in Ferguson, Missouri, with the killing, the police killing of Michael Brown, that kind of then, you know, gave rise to Black Lives Matter. We had those same things, those same aspects here in Pittsburgh. And so to see, you know, a few years later, to be in Pittsburgh and to hear about, you know, Antoine Rose being murdered, to see his murder on video, and find out that this was an officer that had been previously fired from his job, that he had been only on the force for 3 hours before he shot and killed this unarmed young man. And then to begin the process of, you know, the protest and making sure, you know, one of the first things we did was, you know, as One Hood, we put a petition out through an organization called Color of Change calling for him to be charged with homicide in this in what happened. Now, you know, he was charged with homicide, although he was given an unsecured bond, which actually goes against the Pennsylvania Constitution. So I think, like, part of why we wanted to bring Sabrina was to give us some guidance in what happens right now. But also, I think it's because we don't believe, I think if you talk to many people of color, that we're going to get justice. We know it's a relationship between the DA and Rosfeld's lawyer. We see now them saying that they're going to select a jury pool outside of Allegheny County. We're seeing all of these things take place. And for us, it's saying, this officer is going to get out and get off. And so now how do we respond in a way that's productive, that's constructive, and that makes sure that we get justice for our community? So I believe Sabrina can help us with that.
My final question is this. Are you an optimist? And the reason I ask you that is talking about a lot of conversations.
Yes.
Are you optimistic that conversations can lead to change in attitude, change in policy where need be?
Yeah. And it's funny because I laugh because if you were to like search just Siri X music and listen to it, you probably wouldn't think I was an optimist. A lot of my music is kind of like, you know, because I'm talking about these really hard issues. It's kind of like, man, it's kind of depressing. You're not going to probably play me at the party. But I really am. I mean, I think this is, you know, sometimes people ask me, you know, how do I keep going, you know, through all the different things? And I've been involved in a lot of movements nationally, as well as locally here in Pittsburgh. And it's because I'm an optimist. I really believe that we're winning. Most of our work is with young people. I've never seen young people more politically motivated, more inspired, and more involved. Even with the protests around the murder of Antoine Rose, it was young people, students from the high school he went to, Woodland Hills, and students that came out of these different schools around Pittsburgh that were really at the forefront of leading this movement. And so to see young people wanting to be involved in this political process, wanting to vote, to see a Leon Ford running for city council, you know, looking at what happened, he could have responded to that tragedy that happened to him, him being shot 5 times by a police officer, him being paralyzed in a much different way. He could have been bitter and angry, but he chose to take that moment and use it as, you know, before he ran for city council, working in our community, dealing with the different beefs in our community, bringing our community together, mentoring young boys. Now he's running for city council. So I'm really excited. I believe, you know, I'm excited by the direction of Pittsburgh. I feel like these conversations, like, we just want to make sure that Pittsburgh is the most livable city for everybody. Not just a few. That shouldn't be determined on your color. Shouldn't be determined on your economic status. We should make sure it's livable for everybody and that everybody has equal opportunities to thrive and grow in this city. And we believe these conversations can lead to that Pittsburgh that we really want to see.
Hip-hop artist Jaziri X, co-founder of One Hood Media, which is presenting a conversation with Sabrina Fulton tonight at the Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. Jaziri, thanks so much for coming in, and thanks for your work.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. According to Pittsburgh's Public Safety Department, the city police respond to more than 13,000 domestic violence calls a year. Now, through a $500,000 grant from the Nina Baldwin Fisher Foundation, the police bureau is creating a domestic violence unit. What impact might that have? Well, let's turn to Nicole Molinaro, president and CEO of the Women's Center and Shelter of Greater Pittsburgh. Nicole, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
More than 13,000 domestic violence calls a year. Very disturbing, but do I assume not surprising to you?
Unfortunately, not surprising. That's in keeping with national statistics. Mm. Very frequent calls for police and very dangerous calls as well.
The grant will allow the city to establish this unit. Currently, there's one dedicated person answering these calls. There'll be four in this unit. So what will that allow police to do that maybe they can't do now, or maybe do better, more efficiently than they're currently doing?
Right, absolutely. So we're very excited about this new initiative. We've been working with the police in the city of Pittsburgh for about a year to really be able to make this a successful initiative. And what we will be doing is working with the police, who will be establishing a four-person unit. So there will be two domestic violence detectives instead of one, that current person, and then an additional detective. There will be added on a domestic violence sergeant, as well as a civilian clerical specialist. And they will be able to do a lot of follow-up, in addition to specialized best practices training and working really in a much more meaningful way than police have been able to thus far with victims and survivors of domestic violence.
Right. So detectives, investigators, follow up. Mm-hmm. But how will the officers who respond to the domestic violence mm-hmm. calls, how might they be affected to do their jobs more effectively?
Sure. Well, they'll be able to get more support through this domestic violence unit. So first responders, of course, responding to these 13,000 calls, already work with the Lethality Assessment Program, which is an initiative that Women's Center and Shelter also partners with the police on. So they have the tools to be able to do a screening and assessment for somebody who's in high danger. However, a first responder may or may not be able to do the follow-up that's oftentimes involved in holding the batterer accountable for their behavior. And so what that means bruises, for instance, when a first responder takes a call, they can take pictures of bruises that may or may not have even surfaced yet. But 3 or 4 or 5 days later, when those bruises are in full bloom, so to speak, a domestic violence detective will be able to do the follow-up necessary so that then that evidence is being able to be presented in court. And instead of the victim being the sole person to really have the burden of saying what happened, there will be evidence that's able to be presented by the police that otherwise may not have been able to be presented.
So I understand members of this unit will get some national training. How will that sort of make its way down to those first responding officers?
Well, we currently work with every officer as they come onto the force, and we also do veteran training. So we make sure that they have an understanding of domestic violence and how to properly respond to calls. So the additional enhanced training that the domestic violence team gets that's really based in national best practices around response, not just to a call, but also follow-up, will really help to enhance that training and bring national best practices to the Pittsburgh level.
A quick follow-up on that is, do they have to be the first responding officers? Do they have to be more attentive, more aware of certain signs as well?
Oh, absolutely. So that's what the training really focuses on, is really looking to, first responders have a lot to deal with as they're answering any call. But as you can imagine, a domestic violence call, which are often so dangerous, and oftentimes two people saying very different things about what happened. So the training involved in trying to figure out what went on, and then, of course, knowing when to administer this lethality assessment screen, and then knowing exactly how to connect people, as they do now, to services, to emergency safety planning, and to legal follow-up is so important.
Well, I want to ask you more about that lethality assessment. What is that exactly? And you mentioned sort of a goal to build upon the success already there.
Yes. So we've been working with the City of Pittsburgh Police since late in 2014 on this lethality assessment initiative, where they are trained to be able to respond to domestic violence calls and determine when a high danger assessment is needed. So they'll administer a lethality assessment screen, which is an evidence-based, research-based screen that is used on the national level for these calls. And they will be able to determine through that who needs to call Women's Center for emergency safety planning. And so what that means is that about 70% of the lethality assessments that are administered end up with a call to do emergency safety planning with the victim on site and with the police officer in order to be able to better help that person to do the safety planning. And then from there, we connect them to whatever resources they need, whether that is emergency shelter, whether that is legal services, counseling, follow-up support groups, medical advocacy, etc.
Mm-hmm. The grant is for $500,000. Do we know yet, are there any plans to make this unit permanent?
The City of Pittsburgh Police have said that they are very excited about this invigoration of this project, and the hope is that it would be able to be continued long after the five-year grant is completed.
All right. Obviously, policing, detective work, investigative work, is often about data. How will data collected by this unit help the city, help the survivors, maybe help you?
Sure. Creating a database of especially repeat offenders to be able to inform the police work and to be able to inform victims as they go through the court system is exciting and absolutely critical, because if you don't have the information about what has happened in the past with this particular batterer, then it's hard to determine what could happen in the future. But having that information can make crucial life-saving differences.
All right. In our remaining time, I want to ask you about, we talked about how the police will learn, become more effective. How will this unit benefit the survivors of domestic violence?
Sure. Well, it increases their ability to go deeper into the investigation piece of domestic violence cases, which can only benefit survivors of domestic violence. It helps to hold batterers accountable, which also helps domestic violence victims and survivors. And it also creates a more meaningful connection to follow-up services with the legal system, as well as with victim services.
And the center will be involved as this unit moves along?
We absolutely will be. We've been involved in the conceptualization of it, and we will be involved on a regular day-to-day basis with the police in helping to implement the unit.
Finally, you sound fairly hopeful about this unit and its impact on this big time problem in our area.
We absolutely are. We have a great relationship with the City of Pittsburgh Police, who really have already started to institute best practices around the lethality assessment program for the last few years. We're very hopeful that this will only increase the level of capacity for the police and be able to really deepen their ability to help survivors of domestic violence.
Nicole Molinaro is the president and CEO of the Women's Center and Shelter of Greater Pittsburgh. Nicole, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Meg Fair, plus Mick Stanelli, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Linnigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.